Hi folks, how you doing? Hope this finds you well. You find me the morning after the launch of the brand new series of Ahsoka fan event. I was invited along to host and unveil the first two episodes of the brand new Disney Star Wars series that is hitting your Disney Plus platforms 23rd of August, which is tomorrow, but from 2 a.m, which is much earlier than usual. Rosario Dawson reprises her role as Ahsoka, who we've seen very small bits of in Mandalorian and The Book of Boba Fett, but this is her all singing, all dancing, Dave Filoni created, written, partly directed journey. And I've seen the first two episodes. It is outstanding. So if you have been missing out on your regular Star Wars series hitting Disney Plus, then I highly recommend that you check it out. It's kind of got, for me, it's got the trappings of all the things that I loved about the original films. It's got a great tone to it. The droids are brilliant. All those kind of things, you know, those little elements that you kind of take for granted, but kind of all come together to make it brilliant. The colouring of it as well really harps back to the original films and things like that. And Rosario is bewildering as Ahsoka, just calm, collected, completely Jedi-like, almost Buddhist-like. It's fantastic. So there we go. But anyway, on this episode this week, we've got something slightly different for you. As I'm joined by producer Matthew Metcalf and journalist and organised and cybercrime expert Misha Glennie, author of McMafia and Dark Market. You might have seen and watched McMafia, which was made into a brilliant drama with James Norton in the lead. But they joined me separately to discuss this mental documentary called Billion Dollar Heist. It's about one of the most daring cyber heists of all time, the Bangladeshi central bank theft. This is the thing I love about documentaries, is it takes you down into a journey in an area that you kind of step in knowing nothing about, but you kind of come out the other side with many things, actually wanting to know more. It makes you, this made me adjust things in my life, and it's kind of opened up the opportunity to talk to these two about a subject that we don't really cover on this podcast that much, but one weirdly that does connect to a lot that's going on at the minute, AI. So weirdly, it's got a really relevant conversation with regard to the entertainment industry. Billion Dollar Heist is scored by Lachlan Anderson, and we'll hear some of his music during the interview, but we'll begin with some 8-bit gaming music that features in the film Battleman by Cody O'Quinn. Hey Matthew, how are you?
I am well. It's evening here in New Zealand, and it's the sun has gone down, but it's the end of the day. You're in England, right? This is bright and sunny August morning.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a little bit of blue sky. We've not had the best summer so far, so fingers crossed. It seems to be that thing, as soon as the kids go back to school, summer starts. So I think that that's kind of what we're aiming for.
We go back to school in New Zealand just randomly. Our kids go back to school in February, which is the equivalent of your August. So they go back to school on like 1 August. So the hottest month of the year is when school starts back. It's
yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, always the same. Listen, I had the absolute pleasure of chatting to Misha the other day about your fantastic film. So it's lovely to get the opportunity to have a lovely kind of full circle conversation really about the film and the story. But congratulations first and foremost.
Oh, thank you. You know what? I watched it at the New Zealand International Film Festival about 2 weeks ago, And although I've watched the film countless times, probably into six figures, or sorry, three figures, I mean, like over 100 times, I still found myself going, this is just a bonkers, crazy story. It really does fit into the truth is stranger than fiction category.
Where did the journey for you with this story start?
It started actually with the work of Misha Glenny. So he'd done a whole lot of work on sort of what you might call the dark web. And I'm one of those people that can't even program a DVD player or a microwave. So the dark web is like really kind of fascinating. And I was really interested in sort of the history of cybercrime. And Misha's done some fabulous work around that. And we started speaking to Misha, and he's just like this incredible wealth of ideas. And that led to further discussions, which led to further discussions, which led to kind of this sort of what you might call the granddaddy story of them all about cybercrime, the Bangladesh bank heist, increasingly coming up in the conversation, which eventually led us to kind of going, you know what? This is the story we've got to tell because it's just bonkers. And you wouldn't believe it unless it was true. You know, like just the whole concept of it is so crazy. And it's such a cautionary tale, and it's such a tale for our times that once it got into our head, it was like a little worm. We couldn't get it out.
It's quite funny, isn't it? Because you, if someone had written this story, you go, this is so unbelievable. But isn't it brilliant how sometimes the best stories are the real ones?
Look, I mean, obviously, I'm involved in storytelling for a living, and I always know that that saying, truth is stranger than fiction, is true, you know? And one of the things in good storytelling you're always looking for, right, is, and I've already said this word bonkers, is sometimes what you're looking for in a good story is just this sense of no way, really? No, that can't be true. That's ridiculous. And we have to remember that there's a really unfortunate side to the story. Like a lot of people were hurt, and we mustn't forget that a lot of damage was done. The people of Bangladesh who can ill afford to lose $81 million had this stolen from them. We have to remember that despite the bonkers nature of the story, it was a theft. But looking beyond that, it's a story that also causes you to go, no, surely not. No, really? And it just keeps going like that. It just keeps topping itself at every level to the point where you've got people washing cash at casinos in Manila where they're not even trying to win and they're treating it like a 9-to-5 job and clocking off at 5 p.m. and going, oh, well, we've spent our millions today, back to the room. It just keeps giving as a story. It's a crazy story.
When you're thinking about how, you know, collaborating with your other creatives and how to tell the story visually, because that's a really, you know, with this world as well, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to try and project that onto a screen, you know, and tell it in a captivating way. And you've managed to do that brilliantly through the animation and things as well in the film. But when you're coming to the decision about how you tell the story visually, what were the conversations about this and about how you wanted the story to unfold on the screen?
Look, I love how you're asking the tough questions because you're really getting into the heart of the filmmaking journey now and the stuff that caused us so much agony. You know, it can be really
Sorry.
easy when you, no, it's good. I actually love that you're asking because it can be really easy. It's just words to say, you know, I always sort of joke, you know, it's very easy. You can just write on a page and the aircraft carrier sailed up the English Channel. And it's so easy to write that. But to actually deliver that visually is so much harder. And when we got into the really the physical nuts and bolts of making the film, there were things like the cyber aspect of it, you know, the breaking through all the security protocols within the bank. That doesn't really exist. That's a digital-only concept. It's just zeros and ones moving in wires and in cyberspace. And it's like, how do you show that? And one of the biggest breakthroughs that I'm kind of really proud of in the film, because we spent ages on that. Like we drew storyboards and we tried all these different ideas, and we would always come back to it and go, yeah, it's kind of not that interesting though. And then one day there was this breakthrough, and I don't know why, but I'm a sort of a child of the 80s, and video games in the 80s, we had games like Choplifter and Elevator Action, Sega Rally. But in particular, I remembered the way that the games, and I sort of riffed with everyone in the edits, the whole sort of team, we started riffing about the way that games were in sort of the 80s and 90s. And we were thinking about like Sonic the Hedgehog, like really 30 years ago, kind of iterations of that. And we were starting to go, wouldn't it be cool if we showed, you know, the cyber part of it is kind of like elevator action, like a really Nintendo game from the late 80s and the early 90s. And so that idea then went through this huge multiple processes until we eventually invented a game in our minds called Cyber Heist Action. And then we created a musical sting for it. And then that process allowed us to start imagining this character who went around with a drill smashing their way through certain barriers and getting keys until eventually they powered up and found their way in. Such is the nature of the creative process that took months. And when I was watching it 2 weeks ago on the cinema screen, I was like, oh my God, the audience was laughing at that. And I was thinking, oh my God, I swear to God, that's 6 months of work just to come up with that little 5-minute sequence of cyber heist action. So that's my long-winded answer to the craziness of the question.
It absolutely works. But, you know, what you've also done as well is bring in that element of music as well. And that was something, again, it's kind of the conversation around music with, you know, a project like this, I imagine was not an easy one as well, or an obvious one maybe in terms of what you wanted Lachlan to do and involving him in the project.
Well, look, actually, I was working with editor Weather Mole Press, and we were talking about music, and we had this music in, and it just wasn't kind of working at certain places. And then I came back, and Weather said, I've got this idea, you're probably going to hate it. And he showed it to the wider team, and he had put rap music in one of the scenes where they're talking about money and the craziness of it. And he had put this kind of rap track in, and we couldn't license it, but he had put this track in, and it was all talking about gangsters and money and go get your money and stuff like that. And all of us just laughed, and all was like, oh my God, that's bonkers. That's exactly what should be there. So then Lachlan went away and composed a rap song, you know, and a rap track, and dropped it into that section. And we all loved it and went, this is so what it is. Because everything about the film is just kind of dark humor. Here's this kind of a fun fact. One of the things we were inspired by, you've seen like, oh my God, I'm having an embarrassing moment now, Succession. So
yeah,
I think we've all seen Succession, right? And you know, the pilot of Succession, it's got Kendall Roy, you open, and Kendall Roy's in the back of like an S-Class Mercedes, and he's got his big headphones on, and he's listening to like this hardcore kind of, you know, like gangster rap track.
Yeah.
And he's kind of going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like the driver's kind of looking at him going, what?
Yeah, who you is know? This guy? Yeah.
And we started talking about just the ludicrous black humor of that kind of world, you know, where it's high stakes, high money, and how it works so well to contrast the ludicrousness of that, the greed involved, with music and with musical tracks that just completely throw that out the window and poke fun at it. You know, that we're really saying to the audience, we don't endorse this, guys. You know, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, we do not endorse this. It's bonkers. It's criminality run mad. But look how crazy it is. So that's kind of where the music really started to take hold in the film, is when we embraced its inner ludicrousness.
But you also have that brilliant element of almost like a thriller as well that kind of runs through it as well, which I think is really prevalent there as well, you know, in terms of that kind of point of view of the hackers and stuff, of trying to get to the finish line, opposed to the people trying to kind of go, hold on, we realized this was happening and kind of stuff. So you have these kind of two things run in parallel, and that kind of crescendo of a kind of thriller almost as a viewer, you're kind of going, what's going to happen?
No, look, absolutely. Look, you're 100% right to call it a thriller, because it is a thriller. It's a crime thriller, you know, or more accurately, it's a heist thriller. And you've got to follow all the rules of a heist, you know, because that's what you're speaking to, is the absolute structure of the film. You know, like every heist follows a set of rules, right? So a heist starts with someone who comes across some information about how they can break into something. By accident, someone tells them that something's leaked to them, but they find out. Then they assemble a team of people, and then they go in and they start breaking into the bank, the vault, whatever it is, the New York Federal Reserve in this case. And then it goes well. And then in all heist films, you get to a moment where it doesn't go well. Just a little weeny mistake happens, you know, just a little weeny mistake, and it all starts to unravel. And then it gets worse. And then in a heist film, the authorities start to get onto you and start to chase you, and you're running for your life. And that's really what happens in this story. So you're so right. It's absolutely a heist thriller, and it really conforms to those stories. And we very deliberately told the story following those beats because we wanted the audience to get that the enjoyment, the entertainment you get from a good old-fashioned heist thriller.
You know, it's a documentary, but I think it's so brilliant the way that you've kind of creatively constructed the story that you do get that same feeling, you know, as if you are watching, like you say, a kind of good old-fashioned heist movie. And it got me really thinking about my favorite heist movies. And there's a huge list of great heist movies.
Yeah, heist movies are awesome. Like one of my favorites, look, you know, we talked about one of my favorites is a really good friend of mine, Roger Donaldson. So Roger Donaldson's The Bank Job. That is just, you know, that one that is so good. And we would talk about that film as a team, as a creative team, and we'd sort of say, The Bank Job, that is such a great heist film. Like, that's such a great reference for this story. Right into the fact when we think about, in that film, they dig their way into the vaults and they use thermic lances. And so when we were developing the cyber heist action game, we were talking about, you know, in that film, Jason Statham gets in and he digs in and thermic lances his way up through the concrete. And yeah, you're so right.
There's nothing the Stath can't do, whether it's sharks, bank jobs, he's there.
My son, my 10-year-old son, went to watch Meg 2 on the weekend. And he came out just raving about it. So I'm with you. There's nothing the Statham can't do.
Big fan of the Stath. I love as well where creatives, you know, like yourselves, kind of think outside the box with that type of thing. Like, I really loved Edgar Wright's Baby Driver, you know, in terms of the way that was kind of, you know, with the music and stuff, and just kind of how sharp the collaboration was between, you know, the editing and the music and things like that, and the almost choreography, the whole thing as well. It's a great genre of filmmaking, I think.
Oh, God, yes. Like, crime thrillers are perpetually delivering because they deliver all your things you need in a great story, which is you need drama, you need an antagonist, you need a protagonist, and you need resistance, and you need pressure, you know? And so when you have a crime thriller, you've got a protagonist, you've got an antagonist, normally the law, and you've got pressure as in bad luck and the law is coming down on you, and you've got consequences, which you go to jail forever or die if you don't pull it off. So it's great storytelling.
When you are thinking about, you know, your next project, do you react to things that connect with you, or do you seek things out, or is it a combination of the two?
you know, I love how you're asking all the cool questions because you know what?
Oh, thanks.
It's a little bit of all of the above. Some of the films I'm most proud of have literally come down to I couldn't get to sleep and I was turning something over in my mind and it was like a little worm in my mind and it wouldn't go away, little tick. And eventually you just kind of wake up and you go, oh, I've got to make this film. Like I've and this idea, it won't go away. It just keeps pinging away in my head. So, you know, when I look at, I can look back on so many films that I've been involved in and they've come from this place of, oh, that'd be such a cool way to tell a story. You know, like, couldn't we do that? Or couldn't we do it this way? Or couldn't we do it that way? And then once it gets in your head, it's like a tune that won't leave. And it's just like the only, you've got to get it out of yourself and you've got to tell the story.
It was really fascinating chatting to Misha with, you know, with his brain and how involved he is in that kind of, you know, cyber world, geopolitics, all that kind of stuff. And you know, I learned so much from the conversation with him as well. And I think the film does so much in terms of, you know, as well as it being a great piece of entertainment, it really informs as well, you know, in terms of all the stuff that's going on, you know, digitally with regards to crime. And is that something you think about, you know, in terms of the kind of the informative nature of the
Oh, well,
filmmaking?
look, I'll tell you what, like I roll with two-factor authentication now on everything. You know, like let me say to all of your listeners, two-factor authentication, trust me, get that stuff. Like two-factor authentication makes the likelihood of you being hacked go down a whole lot, you know, so get that. But even beyond that, one of the privileges, and it is a privilege of what I do, is that for a moment in time in your life, you get to really learn about something, you know? So, for a moment in time, I have the privilege, and again, it is a privilege to speak to and hear from the finest cyber minds in the world. And that is really a lovely thing that makes your life rich and interesting, you know? Like, talking to Misha is a great way to feel like you should have paid more attention in school, you know? Like, he is so bright and so learned. And so lucid and able to explain things. And you always just end up sort of looking at the ground going, oh my God, you know, I really should read more books.
But he does it in a way that's really easy for you to understand. You know, sometimes you get people who just talk at you and you're kind of going, hold on, wait. He's so brilliant in the way that he talks about things that he really makes it accessible for everybody, I think. And that's what's brilliant, I think, about the way that
It
he.
is, it is. And that's the, again, that's such the lovely part of my job is just for that moment in time for the, it's really like 3 years, but for 3 years, I get to learn from these people, talk to them. They welcome me into their lives in a way, and you're kind of part of what they do. And it's the most interesting and amazing way to be to just learn like this all the time. You know, I've made movies about racing car drivers, about MotoGP bike riders. I've made movies with famous economists. And in each time, you just get welcomed into this amazing world where someone's devoted themselves to this like one subject, and you hear from them and learn from them, and it's so wonderful. It's stressful because you've got to deliver for them, you know, you don't want to let them down, but it's kind of cool at the same time.
Do you know what's next?
Look, I'm always just working on crazy things. You know, I don't want to give anything away, but I can say that I've been looking at, I'm spending a lot of time looking at late 90s television commercials and music videos because that
Ooh,
was a
that's my world.
really, like a really interesting time. And I'm really interested in that time and the creativity and the art and the way of communicating that was going on in that time. So I don't want to give anything else away, but I'm really into that time.
Nice. I was on MTV in the 90s, so that was my
No way.
which weirdly kind of was broad MTV UK was broadcast in New Zealand.
Yeah. I
Yeah,
love MTV.
I was
Are you kidding me?
Probably on your TVs when you were watching those videos as well, doing Select and Hitlist UK and all that kind of stuff as well. So
Oh my God.
it was a great time. It was a
That
very
is
fun
how,
time.
look, MTV was so influential
I
on my
loved it. I
filmmaking
learned.
journey.
I mean, it was an amazing training ground for me. It was just extraordinary. You learned so much on the job.
But even about the way that the MTV titles worked out, you know, with the sort of, you know, the guy, the space guys, and the taking the whole Andy Warhol color saturation negative
effect.
Am I an
MTV award?
That's so cool.
When I left, I got my award for best MTV, best news presenter ever. So that's my, I got my wobbly MTV award. Yeah.
That is so cool because MTV is so, as I said, it's just so influential. And MTV was one of those things that I look back on as someone who works in the arts and go, I think it's really time to pay homage to MTV.
Yeah.
I think to really reference back to its influence, because it drew from people like Andy Warhol, it drew from artists like Basquiat, and it moved into music in a whole different way. And it's obviously its influence on pop culture is just beyond profound.
Well, please come back and talk about that then once you've made the film, because it'd be great to pick up on that for sure. That'd be awesome.
Oh, man, now you've got me really excited now. I'm kind of like, I should be playing in that little, maybe I should jump into that pond. But that's such a cool area. But I'm so stoked that you worked on that. And that's so
cool. It was great. I loved it. One of the happiest periods of my life. It was absolutely fantastic. And made lifelong friends throughout that time as well. It was great. And yeah, learned so much as well. Before we leave you, Matthew, we really like to get, you know, something where you, with friends, you kind of trusted people that you go, they'll give you recommendations and stuff. And so all we do is ask our guests for a couple of recommendations of things they've either seen, watched, listened to, something that really is just connected with you that we can pass on to our listeners that go, oh.
I'm going to tell you something really cool to your audience to go and do. Get on YouTube and look up the boo.com. So that's B-O-O, boo.com television commercials from the late 90s, directed by Roman Coppola, you know, Sofia Coppola's brother, Francis Ford Coppola's son.
Yeah.
He directed these television commercials for boo.com. One of them takes place on the New York subway, another one in the streets of New York. I think it's New York or maybe it's LA, but these commercials are so groundbreaking and so ahead of their time. They are absolutely brilliant. And boo.com is the subject of a sort of a best-selling book because boo.com was the Net-a-Porter of the late 90s, and it went bust. But these commercials that Roman Coppola did are so clever and are so artistically influential, and so many other artists reference them now. So if for all of you out there watching this, if you want a little gem, a little hidden gem that I pretty much guarantee you that 99% of you don't know about, boo.com, TVCs, Roman Coppola, you'll find them on YouTube. They are so cool. They're a great
Amazing.
Watch. That's my little offering for today.
There's my rabbit hole for the rest of the day. Lovely. Thank you. Matthew, so great to chat to you and really kind of, you know, dig into the creative process for Billion Dollar Heist, and I'm really excited to see what's next. And thank you so much for your time to this evening, I should say.
Pleasure. It's been so much fun. Take care. Have a great one.
A wee bit of Lachlan Anderson's score to Billion Dollar Heist, rounding off the first part of this soundtrack in double with Matthew Metcalf. And so to Misha, who narrates the film and very much is part of this whole story, as you'll hear. And I wanted to share this with you because although we don't talk music specifically, it's a genuinely fascinating insight into the threat posed by cybercrime. And as I mentioned, Misha wrote McMafia, which was fictionalized brilliantly to great acclaim by the BBC. So what better excuse than to play Tom Hodge and Fraz Kerman's main title theme. Misha, how are you? Thank you so much for your time today.
That's all right, Edith. I'm well. I'm in Vienna, where I am the rector of the Institute for Human Sciences. Who knew?
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I could spend an entire day, to be honest, talking to you about your wonderful career, because it covers so many bases. It's a fantastic adventure you've been on in your life so far. But there's lots of little things, if you don't mind, I'd really love to talk about, and start with Billion Dollar Heist, which is this. I always find when I watch brilliant documentaries like this, you kind of watch it going, oh my God, aren't the best stories the real stories and the ones that are actually happening, which can be terrifying sometimes, but this is an extraordinary story, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's an incredible story, the Billion Dollar Heist, because frankly, because of the scale involved, you know, the ambition was extraordinary. And this issue of scale is something that's very important, because around about 2012, 2013, the FBI noticed that there was a sudden collapse in the number of physical bank heists going on in the United States. I think it was in 2015, they noticed that it had dropped over the 12-month period to about $17.5 million. In all bank raids over the entire United States. And something like the Billion Dollar Heist, even though they didn't manage to get the $1 billion they were aiming for, they still managed to come away with about $81 million. So, you know, the scale is just ridiculous with cyber-based criminality. Your aspirations are just that much greater if you're good at what you do, and you have to be good. I mean, you know, this is not something that anyone can just sit down and do, although many try. This required a lot of planning, a lot of skills, and a lot of human intelligence. And even then, they managed to screw it up.
Just from you saying that whole thing that the FBI had noticed, oh, bank raids are down, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? That in itself is such a crazy notion that someone's registered that, and that has then ignited and go, okay, well, what's happening?
Where's it all gone?
Yeah. It's so bonkers thing.
Edith, there was a funny, I mean, this is a sort of combination of both the work I did on McMafia and the work I did on my book on cybercrime, Dark Market, is that you had this period in the 1990s and the early 2000s where basically traditional organized crime and cybercrime were running on parallel tracks, and they never met in the middle. And I interviewed, particularly during dark market, I interviewed people who were involved in cybercrime who had come from traditional organized crime backgrounds, i.e. their parents, rather specifically their fathers, have been involved in traditional organized crime. And they explained that initially, when you got young bucks coming up through mafia organizations, they were trying to persuade the older generation that the real money was in digital. And the older generation who weren't digital natives basically said, oh, I can't get my head around all this newfangled stuff. And they carried on with their extortion, their drug dealing, and so on and so forth in the traditional manner. And then in the mid-2000s, you started to see a shift in the leadership of mafia organizations around the world, with people, with the younger generation coming in who knew, who understood how powerful digital was. And you started to see the process of the merging of traditional organized crime with cyber criminals. And two things happened in this case. First of all, what the cyber criminals did was they adopted the models, the structure models of mafia, which is the cell structure, so that nobody really knows what anyone else in the organization except the Mr. Big is actually doing. So you get people who concentrate on money laundering, people who concentrate on malware development, and no one really knows who anyone else is. So that if the police bust one person in the team, they can't get to the rest. And traditional organized crime just basically realized that their work would be much more efficient, as any organization was, if they adopted digital techniques. So that's what happens. And then you get a boom with trad organized crime and cyber criminals coming together in a way that we'd never seen before.
I mean, it's a big conversation, and there's so many avenues that we could take in terms of what, you know, what we could talk about. But with regards to a normal person, in terms of the fear around cybercrime that could affect your average person on a daily basis and stuff, it just seems to be kind of growing, and the growth of it is kind of, you know, you go to your junk mail, and the amount of kind of things that have fallen in there of people trying to get access to any kind of details of you is kind of like the number of that it's multiplying is terrifying sometimes as well. Is there a next phase to it? Is there something that's beyond cybercrime that's the kind of next thing? Or because it's either going to implode, or it's kind of something else that's got to kind of materialize out of it almost in a way.
Well, the next thing in cybercrime is artificial intelligence. And we're already seeing that. So along with ChatGPT and GPT-4 that you will have heard of, OpenAI, we now have something called FraudGPT and WormGPT. And these are artificial intelligence programs written by criminals, which are designed to aid other criminals in perpetrating crime over the internet. So one of the things that FraudGPT does is it writes much better fake letters for you than you can do yourself. So people who are launching a phishing attack, that's sending an email which you'll download the attachment and infect your computer, i.e. persuading you to do something with your as a customer, as an ordinary person, with your computer that you shouldn't. One of the problems with that always was that you could tell, because the language was so bad, that you could tell that it was a fake operation. So you just ignored it, or you sent it to spam or whatever and reported it. Now what they're doing is they're becoming much, much better at writing letters which look not just as though they come from, that they're well constructed and well written, but they look as though they come from someone that you know. And it can even ape the style of writing that person would use. These before were always things which you could use as a check when someone was trying to hack into your computer through a phishing attack. You would always know how your mother wrote to you, how your best friend wrote to you, or whatever. Now you can't entirely be sure who it is that's writing to you, because they can ape and imitate the language that you use much better than was the case. And they can do that by going through all your public writings, your emails that are available online and that sort of thing.
Wow. It's so interesting because the AI conversation is something that we've been having. This podcast that I do called Soundtrack, and where I speak to, you know, people in the creative industry around film and music, and you know, obviously there's a huge conversation going on right now with regards to the writers and in the States, and actors as well, just in terms of that side of things and the representation of human form in AI and the ownership of that, and, you know, kind of relinquishing almost control of your image. That's a big discussion around that as well. But interestingly, I was chatting to Asif Kapadia last week, the wonderful British filmmaker, who his next film is very much in kind of your realm in terms of what he's planning on doing. And he drew to my attention just in terms of how this whole discussion around the creative industries is almost kind of distracting from another element of AI, particularly around next year and the number of elections that are happening around the world and how AI is going to be a huge part in that and what it can fabricate and what it can do.
That's absolutely right. I mean, here at the Institute where I work in Vienna, we are focusing a lot on this, on AI and elections. We've got a whole string of elections coming up here in Central Europe, in Slovakia, in Poland. And then, of course, next year, we've also got the presidential elections in the United States. And everyone is extremely worried about the flood of bots and, you know, videos which are made by artificial intelligence, which nobody has to sign off on. They don't yet have a watermarking system on these things. And so this is a real concern. AI and politics, AI and the creative industries. I myself did a little bit of a study on the impact of AI in publishing. And it's coming at the publishing industry like an express train. But at the moment, people think that the light is the end of the tunnel and not the express train itself, which is what it in fact is. So there's a lot of problems here. And the other thing is the crime aspect, because it was 3 years ago that I was alerted to GPT-3 when a friend of mine, who actually also appears in the film, Mikko Hipponen, who's a Finnish cybersecurity engineer, he had been invited to California to go and test out, because he's a very well-known head of the technical department at this cybersecurity company, test out GPT-3. And he came back to Europe, rang me up and said, I've just seen the future and it's terrifying because GPT-3 can write its own malware programs. And he had even asked it to write a polymorphic program, which is a piece of malware, which when it encounters a digital defense system, is able to rewrite itself in order to get around that defense system. He said this is very, very disturbing. So things like the $1 billion heist, if you get the core program in the hands of criminals, and increasingly it's going to be able to do that, then it's just going to be a boom time for them.
God, it's crazy. $1 billion heist. How does this particular project come to you, you know, in terms of your involvement in it?
So after I've written Dark Market, after I wrote McMafia, first of all, and I interviewed a couple of cyber criminals for McMafia and also some security engineers. And I realized then when I was writing McMafia that cyber was going to be incredibly important in the criminal world. So I decided, as it turned out, prematurely, I think, I published it too early.
You're ahead of the times, Misha.
to write Dark Market. And so it was the production company that got in touch with me first. This is about 18 months ago. I'm just looking up to see when it was. Anyway, about 18 months, General Film Company in New Zealand. And I started speaking to Matthew, who runs the company, and he wanted initially to make a film of Dark Market, of the book, a documentary of Dark Market. But that was actually already under contract with the BBC for a fictional drama. And so instead he said, well, look, I'll buy up the nonfiction rights and we'll do something else with it. And so he asked me, he said, what is the biggest cybercrime that you know of? And I said, well, in 2016, the one that everyone knows who's involved in cybercrime, in early 2016, this group of hackers, we think from North Korea, although it's not 100% ascertained that, tried to steal $1 billion and got within about 2 hours of achieving that $1 billion. Nonetheless, got away with about 100 million. And there's actually been nothing to compete with it. There have been some big hacks since then, but nothing quite as ambitious as this. And as it turned out, even though everybody in the cyber security or cybercrime community knew about this hack from beginning to end, that it hadn't really penetrated the wider world at all. And that actually points, Edith, and this is a really important thing about the difficulty of making either fictional or nonfiction films about cyber and cybercrime in particular, because so much of it is nerd in front of keyboard doing a lot of typing of numbers. And it's, you know, it's Mogadon for television. It's death to television, basically. And so you've got to think of ways of doing it that breaks through the classic screen keyboard problem that cyber always faces. And so Dan decided, the director, he's a very, very talented director, Dan Gordon. He's from Sheffield, big Sheffield Wednesday fan, but that's an entirely separate
Everybody
issue.
Has their issues.
Everyone is there has their issues. But he did an a couple of absolutely brilliant films. One was on Hillsborough, on the Hillsborough disaster, and one was on Australia, and a really brilliant documentary, The Australian Dream, about the pervasiveness of a non-recognition of racism in Australian society. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So he decided to do a mixture this time of essentially of animation and interviews. And the animation is done, I think, really, really well, and is what takes the film out. Because, you know, it's good to have lively interviewees, but talking heads on their own aren't going to do it. So he decided to go for that mixture, and I think it worked really well.
It's wonderful. I mean, you say that kind of thing of trying to break through to get people to, I guess, pay attention to what's going on, really. Your work has had this fantastic journey of going from page to screen. You know, it's got this great thing, McMafia, James Norton, and that. Real, you got someone like James Norton fronting the story, everybody's going to pay attention, you know, great talent. I mean, and that was a fantastic production. You must be very happy with how that translated onto to screen.
Do you know, McMafia was an absolutely terrific experience. I have to highlight the writer-in-chief, Hoss Amini, who's also the creative. Hoss did an absolutely fantastic job, as did James Watkins, his co-writer, co-creator, and the director of all 8 episodes. And because the two of them had worked together, because we were doing it over 8 hours, it was really like an 8-hour film, but broken up. And it was a bit of a slow burn in terms of audience reaction, but that burn got brighter and brighter. And I worked quite closely on it. I was in the writer's room for it, and I was there throughout for filming and for as a consultant, and it made a lot of money for the BBC. It had a big impact on politics in the United Kingdom in particular. It took the word McMafia, the title from my original book, and turned it into a concept, as it were. And James is really critical for McMafia because he's a very, very smart guy. He got a first from Cambridge. In fact, I think a double first from Cambridge. You know, he read the book. He discussed it with me, with Hoss and everything. He really wanted to understand who this character was, where he was coming from, and so on and so forth. And in the end, it turned out to be a really successful show. Made a lot of money for the BBC and for Amazon and for AMC, and we're thrilled with it.
We're involved in the whole side of it. You know, when something like that is taken onto that side of it, or that creative industry, then your music is a part of it. And, you know, Tom Hodge and Franz Kerman, who did the music for it and stuff. Were you part of those conversations at all?
I wasn't involved in the music, although I like the music a lot. But I actually appear in the film. I even have a speaking part in episode 5, reliving.
Look at your
life.
Face lighting up when you're talking about that.
Yeah, it was great. It was like I actually, oddly, my degree is in drama. I majored in drama at Bristol University, yeah. And so I did a lot of acting then. And so it was fun.
Finally
to
got to exercise
back
his
in
job.
The saddle. So that was fun. And yes, I was very involved. I mean, more so than writers usually are. And that's, I think, primarily because Hoss and James were just very intelligent people to work with. And so rather than seeing me as a threat, because you sell the rights to a book and that's it. You no longer have any control. You don't have control over how it's going to be filmed unless you're, you know, so famous that you can write in editorial control into the contract. And basically, for most people, you can't. And it's odd to have a book, either Dark Market or McMafia, to go from nonfiction to fiction. And I had seen both Hoss's and James' work, and we had long discussions before we got going. I fully trusted them, and I was right to invest that trust in them. And it meant that they didn't feel threatened by me at all. And I was just thrilled that, you know, suddenly the audience for this subject, which is the globalization of organized crime, the politics involved in it, the corruption of global politics and so on, had a much, much bigger audience. So it was just great.
There are certain films, you know, I think that really connect as well when it comes to the subject matter and make you kind of internalize slightly on your actions and being more aware of things as well. One for me was The Dissident, which I don't know if you saw, about the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
I mean, I know the Khashoggi story very well. I didn't even know. I mean, it's terrible that it's passed.
No, there's
by.
An amazing documentary, and the way that they tell the story about the kind of they're almost like human bots who are on social media trying to kind of, you know, with the trending and how that can influence things as well.
Yeah.
It was kind of a really sort of, and also the you know, with the cybersecurity on your mobile phones and things, by simply kind of going onto a site, it can open your phone up to, you know, simple things, but kind of was like, you know, within this fantastic story, it was, I was learning sort of so much. And I think that that's something that's so brilliant about your books, but also the way that they're taken onto screen, whether it be through, you know, documentaries or through drama, they really kind of, they're telling human stories and real stories. And that's kind of why they connect. What's the thing that makes, that ignites you to sit down and want to, you know, research and start telling a story about a specific thing, you know?
I think it's things that I come across which I identify as very important, but which haven't yet sort of grabbed the general attention. And what I want to do, so I decided to write a book about crime. What I was really writing about was about politics and global politics and what had happened to the world since the collapse of communism in 1989. That certainly pertains to McMafia, but in terms of Dark Market and then the Billion Dollar Heist, what I identified fairly early on is that question that I raised at the beginning, the question of scale. I'd been doing some work, funnily enough, this unrelated, on the Renaissance and Reformation and about the impact of printing on political discourse in the 16th century.
Wow.
And then I started looking at the impact of telegraph and rail on political discourse in the 19th century. And I realized that the information technology was one of these moments where technology is going to change social life upside down.
Mm-hmm.
But with the internet, in which you have no central control really over the internet, it's atomized and dispersed to all of these individuals, the rate of social change is much, much faster than was the case after the invention of printing and the book, and or the mass distribution of the book, or indeed during the Industrial Revolution. It's just much, much faster now. So you have the thing of things like MySpace, which seemed to dominate everything for about 2 or 3 years, and then it collapsed after about 2 or 3 years. Things go up and down very quickly. Mm. And humans find it ever more difficult to get any sense of control over what is going on in the world. And that's why I thought Dark Market was an important book, is to describe that how you only need a few people who recognize the negative side of cyber to be able to wreak havoc in a way that we haven't seen before.
Do you ever kind of, not fear for your safety sort of thing, but is it something that you think about with regards to things that you are talking about and you're, you know, unearthing sometimes? Is it something that you consider?
I had some problems after McMafia, but they're problems that went away, one from Bulgaria and one from Montenegro. But when I'm researching the books is probably the most dangerous bit of all. So, for example, on McMafia, I went to see members of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, who were basically a cocaine cartel in fatigues. And that was risky. So there were several meetings I had during McMafia, which had a high level of risk. So what you're always having to do is to lower your risk as much as possible. You only go through intermediaries and interlocutors to get to these people, because you have to go through intermediaries almost invariably, who you really, really trust. And you put little quiet mechanisms in place to make sure that if something goes wrong, then other people are alerted to it and will react relatively quickly. On the whole, once you get in front of people, somebody who's whether a hacker or whether a corrupt politician or an organized crime person, you have the great advantage that there is nothing that people like doing better than talking about themselves. And so once they no longer feel threatened by you, it's yada, 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 yada. And they talk and talk and talk, and they become quite relaxed about it. And that's, once you've got them in a sort of relaxed situation, that's when they tell you when they first became engaged with crime, or when they were doing their first deal or whatever. And that's when it's you're sitting there, and as a journalist, you're sitting there and you think you're just waiting for the interview to
this
be over. Getting it. Yeah, I got it. Done it. And then you get safe back home.
Yeah. Oh, it's been so great to chat to you. One last thing. Do you ever listen to music when you're writing?
I do listen to music when I'm writing, but I will listen to classical music when I'm writing. When I'm driving or out on a trip, then I'll listen to all sorts of music. But if it's a song that I really like, I can't concentrate on the writing. If it's kind of, you know, if it's relaxing background baroque or classical, then that's fine. By the time you get to the romantics by Rachmaninoff or Tchaikovsky, I can no longer do that because I'm listening to the tunes are so compelling.
Oh. Misha, it's been so wonderful to get to chat to you. Really, really is. I've got a billion other things that I'd love to chat to you about, but maybe we can do that another time. But thank you so much for being so generous with your time today and chatting to me. And I look forward to what's next as well. So, thank you for what you do.
Okay, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. And it's nice meeting you, albeit virtually.
You too.
Thank you.
From Tom Hodge and Fraz Kerman's score to McMafia, that is How to Talk to an Intruder. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Matthew Metcalf and Misha Glennie. My huge thanks to both for taking the time to talk to me. Billion Dollar Heist is available to rent and own on digital platforms now, and I highly recommend that you watch it. It's one that you can watch, you know, I've got a teenage son and it's something that I want to sit down and watch because it's definitely relevant to their age group as well in terms of what's coming, what's there already, and kind of what we should be thinking about. Head to edithbowman.com or wherever you get your podcast to hear every single episode of the podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtrackin' UK, and check out our YouTube channel for loads of extra content. We've got Ludwig Göransson and Greta Gerwig who've just recently gone up there. Next week, in fact, over the next couple of weeks, we're really focusing on little independent British films, which is a lovely and much needed thing to do. And kind of almost like in the current state of things with the strikes still ongoing and talent as such, you know, both in the form of directors who write and actors not really being available, it's a lovely opportunity for us to kind of open your eyes to maybe smaller projects that you might not have known about. So first up, we're going to be talking about Klockenluder with Neil Maskell and Andy from the Shortwave set, who's done the score for it. And that'll be followed by Ryan Hendricks talking about his film Mercy Falls. Both of them are going to be out in cinemas from the 1st of September. So please do your bit and get out there and support little independent British films. So Klockenluder and Mercy Falls, both out in cinemas on the 1st of September. But next week, you can hear me chat to Neil and Andy about their film Klockenluder.